Hello.
Podcast of verbal narcissism for ugly journalists.
Hello, can I talk to Mr. David? Dave Allman?
Approach and identify.
Hello.
Is it possible that we two, you and I, have grown so old and so inflexible that we have outlived our usefulness? Would that constitute a joke?
From the packed Northwest studio of the Podcast 99 Network, located in beautiful downtown Silverdale, Washington, this is Plausibly Live, the Dave Bowman Show podcast. Now, here is your host, the submarine-qualified, well-coffeed, rules-driven, elitist history buff, Dave Bowman.
Weapons con, you have permission to fire.
Have permission to fire, con, weapons on.
Well, good morning, good evening, or good afternoon, wherever you are, whatever you do. A lot of things happening in the world today, most of them far beyond our control, you might say. So perhaps it's time we took a pause and thought about life and thought about the laws of gravity. The hottest part of the Cold War, Me Too and America's Dad, Michelle Wolf, question mark, and humanity. Don't touch that dial. Just try to hear me out for a while. I once watched with my mouth agape as the Berlin Wall fell in the heat of the new Cold War. Did another such moment just happen? I literally had never heard of Michelle Wolf before this Sunday morning. The only thing I know about her now is what Mr. Spock taught me almost 50 years ago. Bill Cosby convicted of sexual assault. There's many questions about the conviction as there are answers. Here's how you get a hold of me. Text machine, area code 209-565-DAVE. Email is dave at thedavebowmanshow.com. And of course, we're on the web. Just look for The Dave Bowman Show on Facebook, Twitter, and iTunes. Eloqui conitio. The greatest enemy of knowledge is not ignorance. It is the illusion of knowledge. Well, I'm home. It was an interesting vacation. It was a good vacation, like most vacations, miniature vacay of the miniature type. It had its excitement, and it had its So Ben, as you know, the Titanic thing, we took him to see the Titanic exhibit in Spokane. And when we got there, of course, we didn't want to tell him until we got there. And so we're trying to find it, and we get there literally 45 minutes before it opens. And so we're trying to distract him so that his attention isn't on the signs, so that he doesn't see them. We drive around for a bit and played in the park there in Spokane a bit and finally took him over there. He finally sees the signs, and he, of course, is just very excited. And then we have to wait to get in because we're still early, even though we have time tickets. We finally get in, and it was fascinating. I got to tell you, it was absolutely fascinating to me. I mean, as much as Ben loves the Titanic, I've been interested in Titanic for 40 years, I guess, since I was in high school and I read Raise the Titanic by Clive Cussler. And it's a fantastic exhibit if you ever get a chance to go see it. It travels around. I think for me, the most interesting part of it was the big model they have of the wreck on the floor of the ocean. And very detailed and very interesting, and you're able to see things that maybe you don't pick out in the photographs and stuff like that. Anyway, the point is that 5 minutes into this thing, we weren't even out of the first room yet. And Ben was, I'm bored. Because it's not pieces of the ship. It's not, you don't get to see the ship. It's artifacts that they've recovered from the sea floor. So it's suitcases and a $10 bill from the early 1900s that they recovered. I mean, and it's personal stuff. It's connection to people. And he was bored, but it was kind of cool. I mean, we did the, you get a boarding pass with your passenger on it, and you find out at the end if you survived or not. I did not, but my wife and child did. So I guess that works out for me, right? My wife did not survive. Ben was a first class passenger, so of course he survived, because they did. It was pretty interesting. The rest of the weekend was kind of, Spokane, for those of you who don't know, is about, I don't know, 10, 15 miles from Idaho. And Ben just got this obsessive thing. He wanted to go to Idaho. I've never been to Idaho. So we drove over to Idaho, the Love's Travel Store, just across the border. I mean, you know, literally a mile and a half in Idaho. Got a drink and came back. But he's excited. I've been to Idaho. I've been to four states now, Dad. Four states. Well, you got a ways to go, bud. I've got to 47. I still have Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont to get, but otherwise, maybe someday he and I'll just take a trip and go to all the states we haven't been to. So anyway, we're back. And things are slowly getting back to normal as things, you know how it is. So there you go. I have no idea who Michelle Wolf is. I really didn't. I had never heard of her. In fact, when I saw the name flash up and the controversy at the dinner, my first thought, the first conscious thought that went through my head was, why did they have the author of that book as the correspondent dinner guest? I don't get it. I actually thought for a moment that I was misspelling Michael Wolff, the guy that wrote the book about Trump's White House after a year. I mean, yeah, there you go. I actually thought it was him because I couldn't figure out who else it would be. I had no idea who she was. I still don't really know who she is beyond allegedly she's a comedian. I went to a comedy show last week with my cousin. It was his birthday. So we went, we like taking comedy shows and, you know, there's comedy and then there's people trying to tell jokes. She falls into that latter category as far as I'm concerned. I watched it after the fact. I watched the videos of it. Her, even if the material was funny, which it wasn't particularly funny to me, but then again, comedy's in the eye of the beholder, and I get that. Her delivery was atrocious. She would not rate well on the comedy scale. I mean, she's one of those people that if she can read a teleprompter, she's probably fine, but she's clearly not a comedian in the sense of being able to think on her feet and not rely on her script. So I didn't think anything of it. I do know this. I know that Mr. Spock 50 years ago made a comment. The episode was Mirror, Mirror, which is one of the greatest Star Trek episodes of all time. And one of the things that Kirk asked him when they finally get everything straightened out, he was like, well, how were you able to tell that they weren't us? You know, because we were able to convince them that we were them. How were you able to tell that they weren't us? And his answer was very profound. He said, you know, look, it's easier for you as civilized men to behave like barbarians than it is for barbarians to behave like civilized men. They can't do it. And that's what I know about Ms. Wolf, is she's not capable of behaving properly in society. She's just another one of those in-your-face people, just another barbarian who has to behave the way you take me as I am or else, and incapable of actually getting along with people unless she's in control of the situation. So I also know that this whole thing was planned. I know there was a plot. I know that she has a Netflix special coming out, and there's nothing like free publicity, especially when it's controversial. So that's what that was all about. Speaking of Mr. Spock, the movie was Star Trek VI. Of all the Star Trek movies, and I don't want this to turn into a Star Trek discussion, but I think Star Trek VI is probably my third favorite. Number one is obviously Wrath of Khan. Everybody loves Wrath of Khan. Number two is the motion picture. And I know that's strange and I don't have time to get into why, but number three, Star Trek VI, it captures some things that are very personable to me. And that is the collapse of communism, the brave new world of a world where the fears of the past are replaced. I've said this so many times. I'm a Cold Warrior. I remember distinctly watching the Berlin Wall fall and thinking to myself as I stood there watching it next to my roommate, Jimmy, who was, we were both on our way to work when we're watching this fall. And it's like bizarre. What does that mean for us as ballistic missile fire control technicians? How is our world going to change? What's going to be different now? The Berlin Wall falls. And then a couple of years later in August of 91, literally had just gotten out of the Navy. I got out on June 20th. August of that same year, the Soviet Union collapses. And my world was turned upside down in so many ways. It was, my way of thinking had just become anachronistic. It's strange. And Star Trek VI for me captures that. It really does, because it's really about that. It's an allegory about the fall of the Soviet Union and the relationship and the inability or ability of people like myself to adapt to a new world, to a new way of thinking, a new process. And here it is all these years later. And I watched what happened on television in Korea over the weekend. And I had no idea what to think. Most people, when you talk about the Korean War, they have really one source for their information about the Korean War. And that, of course, is MASH, the television series MASH, which ran for 11 years. And it's really not about Korea. It's just set in Korea. It's about Vietnam, but it's set in Korea. And it's the whole idea here is to be as humorous as MASH could be. And I will be the first to say that I have a family member, my sister, who absolutely loves MASH, but I find it dated. I find it stale. I don't find it funny anymore for a couple of reasons. One, because the laugh track is atrocious. But number two, it became, after the first four seasons, it really just kind of became preachy, I guess. There was very little amusing to me, especially after the first four seasons. The first four seasons I thought were well done, but then it just kind of tanked and it was forced. But that's where people get their knowledge of what happened in Korea. And if you ask most Americans, okay, why was there a war in Korea? What happened with the war in Korea? What started the war in Korea? Most of them don't know. Or they have a very broad picture of it. Well, the North invaded the South, and then we had to save them. And then Truman, depending on how old the person you're talking to is, Truman didn't want to win the war. He just wanted to, you know, stabilize things. And that's why the war ended in a draw. And it's fascinating to me because I'm a bit of a historian. I'm a military historian. Korea falls into that category of, in many ways, it is an extension of the Second World War. But in more ways, it is the initial proxy war of the Cold War. It really doesn't fit completely in one side or the other. And when you start looking at it as a broad scheme thing, we today don't really understand it. When it was news back in 50, 51, 52, and 53, there was much more fire, much more discussion, much more engaged politics about it. But it would soon be subsumed in the 52 presidential election. And following the armistice, it would be, essentially buried in the jungles of Vietnam. And Korean veterans to this day, people who fought in the Korean War, are still a little bitter about the fact that they're basically forgotten. In fact, it's often referred to as the Forgotten War. It was one of the last, lines of battle type wars. It was one of the last conventional wars, if you will. And it's a fascinating study in military history. It really is. The tactics and strategies and all of that used are they're basically straight out of the World War II book with some additions into it that cause you to go, that's a new innovation, a new twist, something new we learn. The political causes of it are far more intriguing to me. You learn as you study this a little bit, you learn that Korea was isolated. We knew it existed prior to World War I. We knew it existed. Japan annexed it in the 1910s, just marched in and took over, say, we're taking over. And this caused barely a ripple of anger around the world. In fact, this is the point where Korea begins to be referred to as the Hermit Kingdom. It's not North Korea. It's Korea as a whole is referred to as the Hermit Kingdom because nobody really knows what's going on there. Barely anybody knows where it is, and hardly anybody cares that Japan just marched in and took over. Throughout the Second World War, Korea is a scene of intense combat that nobody knows about because it's all low-level scale, low-scale guerrilla-type actions, as the Koreans themselves, helped by the Russians from Manchuria, are attempting to harass the Japanese. They know that they can't push the Japanese out of there, but they're going to make life as miserable as they can for them, and they do. The communists in Korea are supplied, controlled, directed, run by the Red Army of Russia. And in fact, a guy by the name of Kim Il-sung becomes a captain in the Red Army and serves in Korea. The end of the Second World War, it is simply a matter of logistics that causes Korea to be divided. It's agreed by the superpowers, Russia, United States at that point, it's agreed that we will divide Korea into zones, spheres of influence, but the purpose is to reunite it. Hey, by the way, you guys are in Manchuria. You go ahead and take over the north part. We're in Japan. We'll take over the south part. We'll divide the line at, where should we divide it? And literally, two United States Army officers, one of them is Dean Rusk, who will go on to become Secretary of State later on, literally pull out a National Geographic map and estimate that the 38th parallel runs roughly through half the country, and that's where they draw the red line. Okay, you guys north of there, us south of there, and on we go. And that's how they end up dividing it. The assumption is that there will be elections, free elections. The United States wants open and free elections. The North, controlled by the Soviets, tends to be resistive of that. And of course, when the South holds elections, when Korea holds elections, the North refuses to participate under the Soviets. They refuse to participate. And essentially, you end up with the Republic of Korea, the South Korea, with its president, Syngman Rhee. The North refuses to acknowledge the elections and then holds its own elections, which, of course, the South refuses to recognize. And they install Kim Il-sung as the president for life. And on we go from there. The war comes about because Kim Il-sung. I get my Kims mixed up. You know this, right? It's hard. They're hard to keep straight sometimes. The grandfather. He has an army of 100,000 men with small arms. He doesn't have a lot of heavy weaponry. He has some tanks, most of them T-34s, World War II surplus, outdated. And he's attempting to unify the country. Truman's reaction through this whole thing has been one to not completely ignore South Korea, but he doesn't want a third world war. He doesn't want a nuclear confrontation with the Soviet Union or with China, which has now become communist, with the communist revolutionaries Mao Zedong winning in China. See, these are things we don't think about, international geopolitics with this whole thing. The nationalist Chinese under Chiang Kai-shek have moved to Taiwan. And the belief in the United States, when North Korea crosses the border, the 38th parallel, and invades South Korea, the prevailing belief in the United States government is that this is a feint, that this is a distraction, that the actual attempt here is to get the United States to move troops into Korea and weaken our position both in Europe and our ability to protect Taiwan. Our position was actually that this was a feint to allow the communist Chinese and Russia to invade Taiwan. And so we were resistant to the idea of saving Korea. It's Korea, who cares, was almost the attitude. As it became apparent that we were going to lose if we didn't do something, of course, I don't want to rehash the whole war, Pusan perimeter, 8th Army holds, Walker holds, Incheon, the invasion, we capture Seoul, we cut off the North Korean troops in the south, and we push them all the way back to the Yalu River, and the Chinese invade. The Chinese send 300,000 troops into North Korea. You get into this political argument with MacArthur and Truman, with MacArthur, who is a soldier, well-regarded, but clearly he has other ideas about how things should be run. And the one thing the president cannot allow is the generals to be running the politics, because, again, Truman still believes that this is just a minor thing in an attempt to distract us from the bigger issues of facing with the Soviet Union in Europe China and Taiwan. He doesn't want to get involved with a huge war here. And so when MacArthur pulls his little stunt, he ends up firing MacArthur, sends Ridgway in, Walker in. Walker gets killed. Ridgway comes in. Anyway, they push us back across the line. We push them back across the line. And then we eventually reach an armistice agreement, which is brokered by the Russians, believe it or not. And the South Koreans reject it. The South Koreans say, no, we don't want to do this. All over prisoners of war. And the United States basically says, sign it or else. And they never did. The South Koreans never did sign it. So it was basically an armistice between us and North Korea. And because we weren't going to fight anymore, South Korea kind of had to stop as well. And since 1953, this line has been tense. And this has been one of the flashpoints of the nation. This has been one of the hardest line places in all of the Cold War. All over what was essentially a mistaken idea that this was a distraction when it never was. And remember, MacArthur wanted to take it nuclear, which certainly would have turned it into World War III, but be that as it may. All these years, we've looked at this Korean situation with Cold War eyes. All of these years, we have done this. We have watched North Korea behave badly. I guess that's the best way to put it. We've seen everything from submarines sinking corvettes. We've seen small units crossing the line. We've seen the third tunnel of aggression. Still one of my favorite episodes of Dave and John. We have seen intentions that we always assumed were bad. One of the things we learned about Korea during the last Olympic Games is that Korea has a deep philosophical bent. The Koreans really do. And one of their sayings that I discovered was, an empty cart rattles loudly. And there's a couple of ways to look at this. Has North Korea been rattling loudly for the last 70 years, 60 years? Because it was empty all the time and they were just trying to make themselves big? Or are they rattling now because they're empty and they don't have anything else to do? And so now they're rattling the cart. And the answer is, I don't know. I watched those two people, Kim Jong-un and the president of South Korea, shaking hands across the line. And if you know anything about that building, that particular building in Panmunjom, you know that the border runs straight through the building. And even inside the building where the tables are, where they sit and have their talks, are divided. And on the south, you never go on the other side of the table because that's the north. And the north never goes across the south. And the guards stand outside with their fists pumped and they stare and they don't move and they don't blink. And these two guys come to this line, shake hands across the line. The last person we know that went across that line from the north got shot. Remember that soldier a few months ago who crossed the line and was shot and chased and shot and then survived and then he went to the hospital and they were pulling worms out of his stomach? Remember all that? That's the same line. These two guys reach across that line, shake hands, and then the South Korean invites him into South Korea, that's Kim Jong-un in, and almost without hesitation, he just steps across the line and walks in. And I sat there watching that, and I had the same feeling I had in 1989 and 1991. How does this change my world? Do I really believe it? Do I really think it's true? Is the empty cart rattling because it's a distraction? Is the empty cart rattling because there really isn't any reason to put anything in it? Every instinct of my Cold War blood says it's a trick. Every ounce of me wants to believe that this is just a maskrovka, that this is just an attempt to fool me and South Korea and the world. But what if it's not? If it really was a trick, would you send Kim Jong-un to the border and walk into the... Can you imagine what his grandfather and father are thinking right now? If they were thinking in their graves, I mean, this is unthinkable. A week ago, I said to you, I don't understand how this could possibly happen because, again, the Kim Jongs aren't going to give up power. They don't want to. They don't want to live in poverty. They don't want to be not in charge. They like the idea of being able to shoot people whenever they want. How's it going to work? And maybe it works by starting with a handshake across a border and then both sides walking across it and, you know, just like the Berlin Wall. Remember when it fell and that face, you can still see it poking through, looking around going, look at this. It's literally a distance of inches. But in the words of Neil Armstrong, it's a small step for a man, but a giant leap for mankind. It's hard because, again, I'm a Cold War guy. I can't think of myself in any other way. I can assure you that, well, I got to be careful what I say here because it's, you know, it is what it is. But once upon a time, there were Korean concerns when I was doing my job. And for those of you who may be new to the show, I was a ballistic missile fire control technician, a targeting specialist for Trident C-4 nuclear missiles, which we may or may not have had, because I can neither confirm nor deny. The change here is striking. It is hard for me to get my arms around. I know that the world peace movement is excited. I mean, this is great. I mean, let the doves go. And I keep waiting for the aliens to shoot at it, like they did in Mars Attacks. Because there has to be a trick here. There must be. And then I hear Spock again. Is it possible that you've grown so old and so inflexible that you've outlived your usefulness? That what's needed here is a new way of thinking, a new way of doing things, a new way of considering this. It must be. The empty cart is rattling, but is it rattling because it really is empty? Is it rattling because they don't have anything left? Or is it rattling because they're really coming forward to empty the carts and say, let's have some peace? Time's going to tell. And I go back to Ronald Reagan, trust but verify. Trust but verify. Let's make sure. There's got to be some unease here. There has to be. And I can't imagine Korea sitting there having watched the experience of Germany reuniting, doesn't understand that there are going to be some major problems. I'm not even convinced that they really do want to reunite per se. I'm not convinced that that's the case. Because again, I just can't imagine the Kim Jong's giving up power. I just can't. And South Korea is not going to want them in charge. So where do you go? I just hope that it is a new future. That it is an undiscovered country, if I can borrow a phrase. And that it's real. Just like the Berlin Wall was. Just like the fall of the Soviet Union was. Maybe for the first time in 60, 70 years, we can put our fears to rest on the Korean Peninsula. Tap Pass 565 Dave, 209-565-3283 is the text machine. You want to join me? Email Dave at thedavebowmanshow.com. And of course, we're on Facebook, Twitter. Just check us out there. If you want to jump into the conversation, stay with us. We'll be right back.
Music is a bridge between the material and the spiritual. My name is Harvey Lauer, and I'm 82. As a blind person, you have to be aware that nobody can tell you what you can or can't do. You really have to try things. My folks got me a little radio in 1940, and that was the best Christmas present I ever got. When I was 11 years old is when I started to play music, play the piano, and then the accordion, and then the cello. My wife, who was also blind, was a good cook. When she died, that's when I started Meals on Wheels. America, let's do lunch.
One in six seniors faces the threat of hunger, and millions more live in isolation. Drop off a hot meal and say a quick hello. Volunteer for Meals on Wheels by donating your lunch break at AmericaLetsDoLunch.org. This message brought to you by Meals on Wheels America and the Ad Council.
Well, Jason, I've got to tell you, you're pretty much everything this company is looking for in an entry-level candidate.
Great.
Your resume isn't quite what we're used to, but you've got a fantastic work ethic.
Thank you.
And I'm impressed by how you carry yourself.
So, should we talk about the job?
What? The job? Oh, sorry. Yeah, I have no way of recruiting or even meeting you. This interview didn't happen.
It may sound ridiculous, and that's because it kind of is. There's a huge pool of talent your company is missing out on. Meet the grads of life. Who are they? Talent worth knowing about. Young adults of unique determination and experience. An ideal fit for your company in an entry-level position, internship, or even mentorship. They might not have every qualification you typically look for, but they're exactly who your company needs.
Man, we really could have used him.
Don't miss out on a resource many innovative companies have already discovered. Go to gradsoflife.org to learn how to find, cultivate, and train this great pool of untapped talent. Brought to you by the Ad Council and gradsoflife.org.
What's up, Whitey?
Hey, Scotsman.
We're from the Ale Evangelist Show, and you're listening
to the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network.
Radio Network.
This is I, Dave. Right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. Dan, the photojournalist, texted that he and his wife, I guess, stayed at the same hotel the unsinkable Molly Brown stayed at after the sinking of the Titanic. Ben knows all these people, and he knows all their stuff, so you stand there and listen to him tell you all the stories of the people that you can actually read the story right in front of you, but he's telling you all the other stuff that goes with it. It's pretty interesting. Fascinating event. The sinking of the Titanic. From a forensic standpoint, it's fascinating to look at the ship and go, how did this happen? Because remember, for years, we all thought it sank in one piece and thus would be raisable or at least recognizable as what it was, but it didn't. A lot of people talking about Korea right now, about the collapse of the reason this is happening. I've even heard, even the Godfather's been talking about, well, the cart is empty. That's why it's rattling, because the North Koreans don't have anything left. Their mountain, their nuclear test mountain collapsed and blah, blah, blah. Most of the reports that I'm seeing are in media that I don't trust. The medias that I trust are telling me that it hasn't collapsed, that they clearly had some problems, but, you know, you're testing nuclear bombs. Of course you're going to have problems. Hell, even we had problems along the way. We had a plutonium core that for some reason we didn't need, I guess. They had planned to build three atomic bombs for use during World War II, and they only needed two. And so they had this plutonium core for the third one. They didn't know what to do with it. So they ended up giving it to a scientific laboratory at Chicago, University of Chicago, I think. And, okay, people recognize the fact that this could be dangerous, but they didn't really understand it. Anyway, this little plutonium core ended up killing like three people because they just, you know, take it out and play with it. Bad idea. We've had missiles that are dropped. We're still missing an atomic bomb we lost in 1947 or 57 off Tybee Island in Georgia. I mean, testing and playing with nuclear weapons is dangerous. It really is. So the idea that they've had problems is not beyond the realm of possibility. However, the likelihood is that it's not. Let's see. It's been reported in the Wall Street Journal, South China Morning Post, Wall Street Journal. Even Rush Limbaugh has been talking about it. Jeff Lewis is a nuclear expert at Middlebury Institute of International Studies in Monterey. said that, no, it's probably intact, but it didn't collapse. Yes, there was a 6.3 magnitude earthquake under the mountain in September, and it's possible that the subterranean cavity collapsed, but it's unlikely that atomic testing turned it into fragile fragments, as the South China Morning Post claimed. And they're it's unlikely. It's grasping for straws. It's looking, it's trying to explain something happening without really, you know, this is a convenient one. Well, it's trying to put it in terms that we can understand and we want. We want North Korea to stop doing this. But it seems more likely to me, just as a casual observer, of course, it seems more likely to me that they've managed to miniaturize and they've managed to test their missiles. They don't really need to test anymore. So now's the time where you go to the table and say, okay, what are you going to give us for giving these up? Keeping in mind, and again, I'm a cold warrior, so I'm always looking for the trick. Even if they give them up, even if North Korea says, yep, here's our bombs, go ahead, take them. You can't erase the knowledge. You can't take away the know-how. And once you've done it once, it doesn't take that long to do it again. It really doesn't. So, trust but verify, I guess, is what I keep coming back to. It's what I keep thinking about. It's what I keep worrying about. Bill Cosby convicted over the weekend. I was surprised at some of the reactions to this. I was surprised at Bill Cosby's reaction to this, to be honest with you, but the reaction to the Bill Cosby conviction has really, to me, kind of exposed some of the issues that are going on with this whole all men are sexual abusers and all women are victims mentality that seems to be infecting our country right now. The Me Too movement is all about everybody's a victim. Everybody has someone else to blame for whatever ills and whatever problems that they seem to have developed because of what happened. Now, again, I personally have never been abused sexually. I know far too many people who have. I know too much about it, more than I ever imagined I would want to know about it. My first marriage ended because my ex-wife could not come to grips with the idea that every person, every man in the world was not just trying to abuse her. She couldn't deal with that. She knew it to be a fact, but she couldn't relate to it. There have been numerous others in my family and in my life that have suffered because of this. And it's interesting to see some of their reactions. Some of the reactions are to just basically come apart. And some of the reactions are, you know what? I'm just not going to be a victim. I'm going to be responsible for myself and I'm going to push on. And I think somewhere in the middle of all that is the aim point, I guess. But it's far too easy in our society. It's far too Me Too hashtag, because that way victimhood becomes, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for? It becomes like a medal. It becomes like a something you wear that identifies you as a member of something. Some years ago, back in the 80s especially, I remember this, it was the in thing to become successful at whatever you were doing, then become some kind of abuse addict, whether that was alcohol or drugs. It was becoming drugs in the 80s, and completely lose everything. Completely blow your career to smithereens and, you know, become a failure. And then write a book about what you learned as a failure and become slowly rehabilitated back into society as wiser and older. And, you know, maybe make even a few jokes about it, that kind of thing. And it became this cycle of you know, self-destruction followed by success. Failing upwards is what it was called at the time. But you had to be really failure at it, because then you could write a book and theoretically people would read your book and go, oh, well, you know, I've been there. And if this person can overcome that, then I can too. And it was supposed to be inspirational and what it wasn't, it really wasn't, but you know, that was kind of the approach to it. And it was weird. I always thought it was just strange. I really did, but it was a thing. And in some ways I kind of see this Me Too thing similarly. In the 90s, I went to seminary. Yes, it was a mistake. Yes, it was one of the stupidest things I ever did. Yes, it has resulted in Dave's law that I don't listen to people who say, God told me to tell you something. No, he didn't. God has my phone number. If he wants to talk to me, he can do it directly. He doesn't need you. Because anyway, I got talked into going to by people who were doing so for their own advantage, not mine, but not certainly not God's. But be that as it may, I found myself in seminary, and it was bizarre. This is the early 90s, 1991, 1992, 1993. And we would have these morning chapels where you had to go to morning chapel. And I had a particularly bad back at the time. And it mandated that I stand. Doctor's orders. I had to stand for like 20 minutes out of an hour. I couldn't be seated. Sitting was very bad for my back. And so I would have to go in the balcony where I wouldn't be a distraction to anybody else. I couldn't just stand in the back of the room. I had to go in the balcony so I wouldn't distract other people from their worship. Also in the balcony was a good friend of mine who had a particular job. He drove kids to school, and so he would always be late to chapel. And so he would sit in the balcony too. And so we were up there in the balcony. And he had grown up in Japan, which is kind of, his parents were missionaries, and he had grown up in Japan, which is germane to the story. You'll understand in a moment. For months, this thing would go on, and every chapel, there would be a student assigned to tell my story. So you'd have to give it there, and it was supposed to be 5 minutes, but it always turned into 15 to 20. And over and over and over and over again, I swear to God, for months on end, it was, I was abused as a child. I was mistreated. I was abused. I was, you know, tormented. I swear to God, one guy got up there and said that he was abused because his father wouldn't take him for ice cream one day. And that's why I weigh 400 pounds today. No, you weigh 400 pounds today because you eat too much and you don't exercise. But, you know, you can't say that, because if I say that, then I'm the bad guy, right? It's true. Anyway, after months of this and one particular story that was just so obviously just a cry for attention and a cry for, I just want to be a part of, everybody else has been abused, so I have been too. I turned to my friend in the balcony and said, you know what? Are we the only two normal people here? And he looked at me and he says, I think we are, Dave, but I grew up watching the Flintstones in Japanese, so I'm not really sure if I am or not. It's almost like there's this compulsive need to have been a part of something, whether it really happened or not, or whether it was really abuse or not. Was my father spanking me an abuse, or did it change my behavior and correct it? I had to put Ben to bed early last night because he misbehaved. And it was hard. I don't want to see him cry like that. I know what he meant. I know what he was doing, but you got to correct the behavior, right? Is that abuse? Is he going to stand up 20 years from now and tell people, my dad made me go to bed early. I was abused. Now, I realize we're talking about something more than that. We are talking about, you know, sexual abuse, sexual assault. We're talking about Bill Cosby using pills, roofies, to drug women and have sex with them. Does anybody else find that just absolutely bizarre? Okay. I'm going to say some things that are going to be personal, and maybe they will be upsetting to you. And I'm not trying to be titillating. I'm not trying to be that. I'm trying to make a point. Okay. I am not famous. I am not good looking. In fact, at one point in my life, I had a particular girlfriend who the number one thing people would say to her is, "Why are you going out with him? You're so gorgeous," and he's not. He's, and they would say it to my face. They would say it with me standing right there. And, you know, she always said nice things about it, but then in the end, it turned out she was lying. So, you know, be that as it may. But the point being was, I had to work to get girls to go out with me. I certainly had to work to have sex with them. I mean, you had to bring your game. You're Bill freaking Cosby. Since the 1960s, do you understand that Bill Cosby has been famous and rich since the 1960s, long before he was Bill Huxtable, or whatever his name was, Cliff Huxtable, since long before, 25 years before he was Cliff Huxtable. Everybody in this country, including my grandparents, who are racist as all get out, knew who Bill Cosby was. They bought record albums of his. Record albums, these were things, they were made out of vinyl, and they were round, and you put them on this thing that spun around, and you dropped a needle on it, and the needle picked up the thing. Played them out. Look it up. Google it. Record player. And they'd play them for us, and we would laugh. And laugh and laugh. Bill Cosby. You're Bill freaking Cosby. You're on the Mod Squad. Television star. Movie star. Stage star. Why in God's name do you need roofies to get laid? What the heck is going on there? What's in Bill Cosby's head? What is so screwed up in his mind that he can't just say, "I'm Bill Cosby. Come on." And if they say no, then he goes to the next girl and says, "I'm Bill Cosby." And she probably says yes. Why the hell does he need drugs to do this? Why the hell does he need to assault people to do this? That's the part I can't get my head around. That's the part that I can't understand. Oh, Dave, he's ill. He's mentally ill. He needs to control things. He needs to, you know, he needs to be in charge. Rape is about power, not sex. It's, you know, all these. I get all that. But you're Bill freaking Cosby and you're Harry Weinstein. Do you really need to assault people? And if Bill Cosby needs to assault people, what chance do the rest of us have in the world when it comes to loving, huh? Where's the rest of us? What chance do I have? Spent my whole life being the good guy, you know, and was always very, very cautious about things. When I was in management, I was always very, very hands-off, I dated one gal at work. The entire time I was at work, and she was in a different department, and I made sure to put out memos, and I made sure to let the other department head know what was going on, and that there would be no hanky panky. I mean, if I, as the personnel manager, had to make a decision, it would be made professionally, not personally. And even the gal and I had that discussion, and it was great. But now I wonder, you know, I mean, if all these men of power are just using this to get sex, what in the world is wrong with us? I don't get it. Bill Cosby is convicted while he's sitting there. I don't know if you caught this part, because in the news, most of the stories are dealing with the fact that he was convicted and what does it mean and blah, blah, blah. Is he going to jail? They had a hearing post-conviction. I don't know if you knew this or not, right then, where they're talking about, we want his, you know, we want bail set at this high and we want his passport revoked. And one of the prosecuting attorneys says, well, he has an airplane. He might flee the country. A la Roman Polanski. And Bill Cosby, in the middle of this hearing, says, I don't have a plane, you asshole. The reactions to this across the board from Bill Cosby on down are just, it's almost like he feels like, what, I was convicted for what? And then you get into the whole, this happened how long ago? How long ago did this happen? And why are we just getting around to it now? Oh, you want to open a can of debate and argument. I've had friends who have been victims of sexual harassment and sexual assault who are furious, because they feel like this has minimalized what they went through, because these people waited so long. And, you know, it took me a little bit to figure out why they were so upset, and it really didn't have to do with the length. It did, but the length was a symptom of what was going on. I happen to know people that have been through some pretty severe cases of this, and they went through hell, folks. I mean, they went through hell when they reported it. In an organization that I happen to be intimately familiar with that has a policy that says, we believe the accuser, we believe the person who says this, that is our default position. They didn't follow their own procedures. And they made her life a living hell. You can't even imagine what someone in that kind of position would go through. You really can't. You can intellectually say, well, I understand it, but physically, you can't really feel it. The fear, the difficulties, the concerns, the pressure. Hey, I'm accusing someone of stature, who am I, of doing something wrong. Who are they going to believe? Who are they going to believe? Are they going to believe me with the issues and stuff that I have that they're going to drag out of the ocean? Are they going to believe him, who's wonderful and service-oriented and all of that? Who are they going to believe, even though it's true? And the pressure that they go through when they did this, and the incredible just difficulties. And yet here come these women along, you know, 30, 25, 30, 15, 20 years after the fact. They have the entire power of the nation's press behind them. They have the whole Me Too movement hashtag. They have press support. They have television opinion support. They have people on the radio saying, well, Bill Cosby, he's a bad guy. And they get praised for their courage, and they get praised for coming forward. Do you see why it's upsetting to people who went through this without all that? Do you see why they start going, why didn't they come forward before? Why did they wait till it was relatively easy, certainly easier? I'm not saying it was easy. I'm not saying that these people who accused Cosby, this woman who accused Cosby, was easy for her. Not saying that at all. But the perception of it from the people who have literally gone through hell is much different. And what's going to happen now? Is he going to go to jail? I don't know. He's 80 years old. He's Bill Cosby. You know there's going to be an appeal. You know there's going to be more arguments. You know there's going to be more discussion. You know there's going to be attempts to delay anything from happening. Does that then get thrown into this mix as justice denied, justice delayed, as justice denied? Why should it matter if it's Bill Cosby? Why should it matter if it's, you know, Ted John Smith in Podunk, Idaho? It should all be treated the same, but it's not, is it? And I think that's what victims who have watched this go through, and I've heard from a lot of them in the last few days about how unfair this whole thing has been. I had to go through hell. This woman gets, not only did she already get millions of dollars from Cosby to keep her mouth shut, but now she gets to punish him too. What's up with that? There are more questions than there are answers, folks. And I don't have the answers. I don't know. What I do know is that there's something wrong with somebody who needs drugs to have sex. And I don't mean to have sex. I mean to force someone to have sex with them. If you need drugs to do that, there's something wrong with you. And maybe you should be worrying about that more than you should be worrying about anything else. Because clearly you are screwed up in the head. And I don't really care how successful a comedian you are, how successful an actor you are, how successful anything else you are. That's where the real problem was. And somewhere along the way, Bill Cosby never had the self-awareness to deal with that. He never had the idea that maybe I should think about this. Maybe I should ask my doctor, why do I feel this way? But he never did. And at the end of the day, it's possible he's going to jail. And all that does is piss off half the people that are watching it go. Everybody's happy that he's convicted, but they're not real happy about the outcome. We'll see what happens. See where it goes from there. Well, that's about all I got time for today. Hope you learned something. Hope you had fun. Hope you have a wonderful rest of your day. We will be back tomorrow for a Tuesday episode. I got some stuff in the hopper. We'll get to that. And I'm Constitution Thursday this week. I think it's going to be very interesting. We're going to talk about some of the California killer, California rapist guy, East Side rapist. We're going to talk about some of that because there's some constitutional issues in that that we'll get to. Take the time right now. Tell the people that matter in your life you love them very much. You'd miss them if they weren't there. So don't pass up those opportunities. You don't want to have that regret. Plausibly Live, I'm Dave Bowman. This is my show right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. Make sure you check out all the other great shows at podcast99.org. And we will see you tomorrow for a Tuesday episode of Plausibly Live, the Dave Bowman Show.
Plausibly Live is a Slippery Fish Entertainment production for the Podcast 99 Network. To contact Dave directly, call or text area code 209-565-DAVE. That's 209-565-3283. The email address is dave@thedavebowmanshow.com. For more information or to hear past shows, go to www.plausiblylive.com.
Hey, I'm going to go do something productive. I'm going to go watch television.